So, Bob, I thought we would look at Google News and look at the psychology and counseling articles that are being published recently and maybe have some of that interesting yet light banter that we are able to produce so that the listeners can enjoy it. What do you say?
That sounds good to me.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Bob?
I am your old friend from graduate school, a therapist in practice here in Seattle as well.
Mm-hmm. We have been friends for 23 years.
Yeah.
And
we're coming up on our anniversary.
We are.
Yeah.
Would have been like October 2 or something. Or did we meet at orientation? Was there?
No. We met at ProSem first night.
Yeah.
And you cut your own hair. And I think for our anniversary, you ought to take me out for a beer at the Sit and Spin if it's still there.
It is not.
Oh, well.
But the Lava Lounge is still
there. Oh, the lounge. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we should. October 1-ish, 23. I wonder what kind of anniversary that is. Like ceramic.
Oh, what you get for, I think it's like a Bullets.
Okay, so this first article that I found. So, by the way, I just Google searched Google News of counseling and of psychology, and all of these are the first, say, 15 hits that I got.
Oh, okay, great.
These aren't like, these are just randomized, you know, the first most popular things today. So this first one, published in Eureka Alert, the global source for science news. This article is titled, "People Love to Hate on Do-Gooders, Especially at Work." People love to hate on do-gooders, especially at work. And the opening sentence, "Sometimes it doesn't pay to be a do-gooder, according to a new University of Guelph study." What do you think about that, Bob?
Where's Guelph?
I don't know. Somewhere far away.
Yeah.
But what do you think about that?
I don't know. It doesn't sound right to me. I mean, nobody likes a brown noser.
Yeah.
Maybe it means that.
Well, why would we hate brown nosers?
Because we think they're disingenuous.
Because they're not telling the truth.
Yeah.
They're manipulative.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, that one, but that's not a do-gooder.
No.
A do-gooder, what do you think the definition of a do-gooder is?
I don't know. A brown noser is a look-gooder, not a do-gooder. Do-gooder, it seems to me, is someone who actually is proactive.
Yeah. And pro-social. Yeah. Someone who does their job well.
Yeah.
And is a good person.
Yeah. Has a sincere maybe belief in, adding something, contributing, or helping out, or whatever it is.
Right. So this plays into an internet notion that the nice guy always loses.
Oh.
There's this thing in the manosphere where they'll say nice guys are always in the friend zone. There's like tons of, you're not on the internet as much as I am, but you can tell the contempt I have for this cultural group. It's like this notion that you have to be the asshole to get the babe.
Yeah.
Only the assholes babe, bag the babes.
Right. Is that out of that pickup culture?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all the same kind of thing. So as soon as I read this, I was like rolling my eyes similar. Yeah. You were only rolling your eyes kind of.
A little. Yeah.
I was like, oh boy, here it comes. And so here, let me just read this part here and tell me, if you think, because, maybe they can redeem themselves in the actual article. The study found that cooperative behavior attracted punishment most often in groups whose members compete with each other.
Oh, right.
This was even the case when punishing or derogating?
I think that means insulting.
Like derogatory?
Yeah.
Punishing or derogating the do-gooder lessened benefits for the entire group, including the punisher. This was even the case when punishing or derogating the do-gooder lessened benefits for the entire group, including the punisher. I don't even know what that means. Do you know what that means?
Yeah, I think it means that people will punish a do-gooder even if they suffer before it.
Okay.
Yeah.
However, without competition, cooperation increased, the study said.
Yeah.
Being suspicious, jealous, or hostile toward those who seem better or nicer or holier than us appears to run deep in the psychological makeup of humans, Barclay said. So I just want to say that again. So this follows up. So I'll just tell my thesis as we go here. So right. The only good parts of this entire article are the part that I just read. You know, cooperative behavior attracted punishment most often in groups whose members compete with each other. However, without competition, cooperation increased, the right. study found.
Yeah.
Which this makes sense given what I understand about human nature and empirical science is that when you have a culture or a organization or a leadership who promotes competition among its members, which it's not just competition, it's this either implied or very real threat that if you don't beat your coworker, you will be fired or you won't be given the raise or you won't be given the benefits of this and that. And so you're put in a situation where it's similar to sibling rivalries. Whenever I hear about intense sibling rivalries, I always have found that the cause isn't that the siblings are dicks. It's the cause is that the parents didn't give the kids enough love or the uh-huh. society was such, you know, they were running from war or something. And what happened was the kids felt thirsty and deserving of more attention and love.
Right.
And the little bit that their parents had to give the family, they saw some of that going to their siblings. You know, it'd be similar right. as if you're literally starving from food and there's one cracker to be distributed among six siblings. Well, you know, there's a chance that you're going to look at those six, you know, your five siblings and say, like, I wish all of them were dead so I could get the whole cracker
right.
because my survival depends on it.
Right.
So that makes sense to me. But then... there's this quick, just complete disregard of, so essentially when I read this, I'm like, okay,
yeah.
It's not that the do-gooder is, it's not that we evolved to hate do-gooders
right.
or that do-gooders get punished. It's that when you have a culture of competition and of scarcity, then everyone suffers and do-gooders are one of those people who get targeted, you know,
right.
'cause they're winning and everyone's jealous.
Yeah.
And envious, okay.
Maybe the perception of a do-gooder is that they have enough and so have the capacity to give a little bit more.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they're targeted.
Right.
But it could be 500 other factors that would target people in a competition, a culture of competition.
Right.
Yeah.
It's why we hate the New England Patriots. It's why...
Right.
I hate Penn State for beating us last year. you know, if Penn State was like... Midland of the pack, or if New England hadn't made the playoffs in 10 years, either I wouldn't have an opinion about the Patriots or I might even like prefer them.
Yeah.
Because I would feel bad for them being an underdog, you know. When Philly beat New England, people cheered all over the world.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it was a glorious moment.
Yeah.
And not because people are in love with the Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, they should be, but...
it's because they hate the Patriots for winning, what, five or six Super Bowls in the last 10 years or right. something. It's insane.
Yeah.
And there's never been... and, you know, the perfect quarterback with the perfect wife and the perfect kids and the perfect diet and the perfect lifestyle. You know, it's just like you just want to strangle them. But... you know, it's exactly what this is. There's a competition. Only one team gets the ring.
Right.
And every other city has to suffer, you know, Seattle included. You know, I mean, like right. our most, the worst moment in, worst best moment in Seattle sports history was right. Not giving it to goddamn Lynch.
Right.
I mean, what? I mean, I get it. All the mathematicians and statistics people are like, well, it was second down. They had plenty of time. You know, you got to go with your options. And, you know, statistically, that was fuck you. Give it to Lynch. You're on the second yard line. You have the most powerful, most talented running back, one of the most powerful running backs who's ever lived. Well, I mean, they got like Bettis and like, you know, who else could really compete with Lynch, you know? And he was like, you know, arguably on the downslide, but definitely on the crest of his career. This episode is just me just railing about
It's actually you supporting the article by behavior.
Right, exactly. Because of competition, I'm being a jerk. But if there was no Super Bowl and it was just like everyone wins, then
right.
no one would care to yeah. no one would care enough to hate.
Right.
It's the same way where I hate the quarterback of USC. I can't remember his name, but his USC beat UW last year, and me and my friends just hated this guy. He just sure. looks like a jerk too. And we're so happy because he got drafted in the NFL early, I think, or at least he graduated or something. And it's just like, yay, you know, we don't have to face him anymore. But anyway, so the rest of this article says, so they go from there with like, okay, culture creates competition, which right. creates hatred of people who do good at work.
Right.
Then they go on to say, being suspicious, jealous, or hostile towards those who seem better or nicer or holier than us appears to run deep in the psychological makeup of humans. It's like, how does it run deep in the psychological makeup of humans when it comes from the outside of the culture? Okay. Because like they said, without competition, cooperation increases. So one would actually conclude, oh, cooperation runs deep. And hostility towards do-gooders actually comes from society and the way that you set up your society.
Right.
Here's a quote. What we are looking for in this research is, what are the psychological mechanisms that play into this? Why are people built in such a way that they will react against the overly generous person and want to bring down the person who appears to be doing good? Anthropological evidence from egalitarian hunter-gatherer societies suggests a similar social phenomenon prevented excellent hunters from dominating the group.
What?
So this is just classic crappy science and science reporting where I don't know if it's the writers or the audience, but everyone loves a good evolutionary psychology argument. Everyone loves a good, like, back on the Serengeti, you know, it's like, so it took like two sentences to get to the Serengeti, you know, the Pleistocene. And it's like evidence shows that egalitarian hunter-gatherer societies suggest a similar social phenomenon that prevented excellent hunters from dominating the group. You know, like, how do you know that?
Yeah.
Like, do you have a time machine? Like, you're probably, I mean, one, just so many dumb things about this. Two, hunter-gatherer societies, according to actual experts who study hunter-gatherer societies, because they still exist today,
yeah,
or at least, you know, in that direction, have found wide variety of cultures, behaviors, social mores, psychological phenomenon that exist.
As well,
they're not a uniform thing.
Right.
You know, that's our thought, is like, they're all tribal. They all act the same. It's right. like, nope. Some have women in control. Some have men in control. Some are, you know, polyamorous, and some are very, you know, monogamous. And, you know, and it's like, you know, what are you talking about? And so it's just like you go from a study that basically to me says that society is the problem and an organization is the problem. And a culture of competition and of scarcity is the problem. And they take it from there and say, deep down, we're evil, essentially. Yeah. And deep down, we hate nice people. That is almost identical to what they're saying. I'm not mincing words there.
No, right.
And I just find that to be highly problematic, you know.
It's sort of data mining.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, right there in the middle of the article, it found that cooperative behavior, you know, without competition, cooperation increased, right? That's what without competition, cooperation increased. Therefore, humans deep down are evil. Like, yeah. What? Like, how did that get into there?
Who wrote it?
Who did write it? It doesn't have the author at the top.
Oh.
That is bizarre that you wouldn't have an author. It's just like, it was released last month by Eureka Alert. Anyway,
I think that might have been self-preservation.
I don't think so. I think, okay, so just spoiler alert, the vast majority of these articles are crap. And I think that people can't detect, even including these writers. So let's go to Psychology Today.
Okay.
Which should have slightly more, you know, legitimacy to it. I've read some articles on Psychology mm-hmm. Today and found them to be actually well written.
Mm-hmm.
So this is written by a PhD person, and it's titled Harvard Study: Trigger Warnings Might Coddle the Mind. Trigger warnings may do more harm than good. So
what's a trigger warning?
So okay, well we'll get into this, okay. But this is another internet thing, and especially in the manosphere. But it's really beyond that. It's more of a MAGA thing of university campuses are coddling, the students, safe spaces, trigger warnings. Have you heard about all this stuff? You haven't heard about it. You must not run in the same internet circles that I do. But this is like
what's an internet?
Yeah, famously, Jerry Seinfeld has come forward saying he won't do college campuses anymore. He won't do stand up at college campuses anymore because of how, quote unquote, overly sensitive they are to things that are offensive. You know, like offense. You've heard of like offensive culture, offending culture, and outrage culture, and all that kind of stuff. And so there's this huge narrative right now in the United States, and it actually permeates beyond just Republicans and conservative. It's really it seems like everyone I know has this narrative in their head that college campuses are, it's basically an ageism thing. Actually, when I identify, it's basically like kids today, you know, they're too sensitive and they're little snowflakes and they're narcissistic. They're always on their phones and they want the world to be perfect. Well, guess what, kid? The world ain't perfect. You know, I just love these like Generation X and Generation Y people acting like they came from like the World War II generation or something. You know, when we were kids, we had to deal with, you know, shitty 8-bit Nintendo games. You know, grow the fuck up. You know, it's just like you didn't come from hardship, you asshole. You know what I mean? You grew up in, you know, during one of the most prosperous times in the history of the world and the most prosperous country. It's like calling kids coddled today is like the coddled calling the coddled, you know what I mean? But anyway, but that's the big narrative now is like kids today are, you know, so one of the major right-wing things that they'll say about college campuses is that the professors are letting the students get away with these safe spaces and there are some famous stories where like some controversial figure, like a Republican, leaning person will be giving a talk about this or that. And the students will protest and make it so that the university has to disinvite the person and say like, oh, due to conflict on our campus, you no longer can speak on our campus. Or when they show up, there's like a huge protest and a big rigmarole or something.
Yeah.
And what, you know, these Republicans or conservative people will claim is like these kids believe that shutting down free speech or shutting themselves off from other ideas will create like this echo chamber for them. You know, and there's some legitimate kind of criticism that you could say to that. But
sure.
But what's your sense? So now that I've sort of downloaded this to you, what do you think about all this kind of stuff?
It's like a pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah, how
you're so? Exercising your right to free speech when you say you don't want to hear my free speech. Well, you know, like, yeah, of course I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So this article is primarily about trigger warnings. So you don't have any...
No, I don't know what that term is.
Okay. So it began with PTSD. So, you know, when someone has PTSD, I mean, in your DBT classes, so you say to the group, we're not going to talk about cutting.
Yeah, right.
Or you all also in this group say that they can't talk about suicide, right? Suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
Because it triggers them.
It can be contagious.
Tell me more about that.
So, actually, this happened when I was young and foolish. I didn't understand that rule and so didn't enforce it properly. And somebody talked in detail about self-harm behavior that they did, a non-lethal self-harm behavior that they did to, you know, regulate themselves. And the next week, my client told me that she mimicked the behavior. So the idea of, in DBT land, they say you can talk about it, but you have to call it target behavior and you have to be, you know, nonspecific. You can't say cutting or burning or whatever it is, but you can say I had an urge to do a target behavior or I did a target behavior, but it can't talk about why, what I did in detail, in any kind of detail, because it's contagious. That's the only reason.
Is that coddling them?
No, it's like we want to go up the mountain, so let's not go down the mountain while we're trying to do that.
Is it preventing them from getting better by allowing them to deny the truth?
No, it's being smart.
Yeah.
With the truth.
Right.
Yeah.
So evidence shows that when you do this model and you have this rule, that in addition to all the other things you do, the 99 other things you do,
sure, right,
it helps people to recover.
Yes.
To a point where they don't have as much target behaviors,
right,
or urges.
Now, let's be clear that this is what's done in a class, in a group. In individual counseling, you end up talking about this in great detail because that's not a place where other people are going to be triggered.
Right.
So it's not like, oh, we don't talk about that.
Right.
No, we talk about it,
right,
just properly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So similar to that or identical to that, there were times when, in the middle, so say someone was raped.
Oh, yeah.
Recently or repeatedly, and they had PTSD.
Right.
Now, you can be raped and not have PTSD, but sure, say you're raped, you have PTSD, and this is, you know, 10 years later, and whenever you have anything that reminds you of the rape, you have a visceral reaction.
Right.
Or you were in war, and you saw your friend's head get blown off when he was standing right next to you. So you have PTSD about, you may develop PTSD about that. And
sure,
when you do, then when you hear a loud bang or you smell dust,
right,
or you see a movie about war, or you see a movie where someone's head gets blown off or something.
Right.
Or you see a picture of that friend, or I don't know, you hear a recording of that friend or, you know,
right.
For people who don't have PTSD, let me explain. When that happens, the body takes over. It has nothing to do with your conscious mind. It's like, it's a similar kind of reaction that if I were to strangle somebody or, put them in a room without any oxygen or something, you have a physical reaction to that that can look psychological, right? Like if I, if I strangle somebody, they're going to freak out. They're going to start punching me in the face. They're going to want to get out of the room. They're going to want to rip my hands. You know, there's going to be behaviors, right? Well, it's the same thing when you have a trigger like this. For instance, you're in a college class, and the professor, without any warning, just decides to show a clip from Saving Private Ryan. You know, the opening couple scenes or something.
Oh yeah, right.
And the veterans in the room, some of them who have been through combat, some of them are going to have PTSD. And imagine that you're in a classroom of 500 people, you're in the middle of the row, you know, like three rows back, and you can't get out very easily. And you have to sit there and watch this scene. And your body goes through this physiological reaction where you panic and you might even dissociate, but at the very least, you're extremely distressed. And it's not just like, for people who have never been through this, it's hard to understand. Like, for people who've never been through an event like this, think about the most nervous or the most scared you've ever been, and times that by like 50 or something. It is like beyond just fear. You know, there's fear like, ooh, I'm afraid of heights. If you're just like, you know, normally afraid of heights, or, ooh, that horror movie was scary to me. Okay. That is nothing compared to the physiological reaction that people, there are many people who would rather die than go through another event like that. It's so horrible. And it lasts for months. Like, you can have a triggering event like that, and your brain and body can be off kilter and in a state of severe suffering and distress for days, weeks, months from one event of having to sit through a class when a movie. So the same goes for if you were raped, you're in the middle of the row and you're just going to, it's a class about advertising or something, and you're a marketing student, and you show up to class and you think you're going to learn about how advertising is working. And the professor decides to show you a commercial that was made in Denmark that is targeted to reduce or to raise awareness about sexual assault. And in that commercial, there is an explicit sexual assault on a woman. Let's just say it's the exact kind of sexual assault you went through as a woman. Same as the vet, your body is going to have a reaction to that if you have PTSD and if it reminds you sufficiently of the event, and you are going to freak out and you're not going to come back to class. Because so that's the other thing, is like what these triggering events do to people is it makes their body not trust the world. And so they end up holding themselves up in their rooms for the rest of their lives, because they're like, if I step outside my door, I can't trust society not to trigger me. I can't trust society to not warn me. By the way, there's going to be this clip coming up. So what smart people did, I don't know exactly where it came from precisely, but there was this movement around like, hey, how about we just throw up a trigger warning at the beginning of class? Or better yet, it's on the syllabus before they even get to class. And you just say something like, by the way, today, if I was a professor, I'd say, by the way, today, we're going to be showing an explicit scene about rape. And so if that troubles you, just don't come to class. It's fine. Or don't come to the first half hour. Show up half hour late. No big deal. You know what I mean? It's a bummer that you can't be there to learn from that segment. But I don't want you to be thrown into a physiological reaction of horribleness that will, one, harm you and make you suffer, and two, might throw you into a situation where you can't come to class anymore because you don't trust the university to at least not harm you in this way. That's all a trigger warning is.
Oh, got it.
Or the most innocuous one is the students are filing into class, and you just at the beginning of class, you just say, we're going to do this. If anyone wants to leave right now, you can. Now, that's a little bit more sketchy because you have to out yourself as you're walking out. So
high demand.
Right. But at least it's some, that's like, fuck it. I don't care if I'm embarrassed. I'm getting out of here. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's what a trigger warning is. Now, that is ethical. That is right. It's moral. It's, I hope, understandable, unless you're a sociopath, that should happen. If you want, now, I don't fault society for not understanding PTSD, but because for most people, it's like, well, why? Why would a movie clip, what from their perspective? So fast forward, in time and culture, and trigger warnings become, the amount of people on the internet that understand trigger warnings as opposed to the amount of people who understand actual PTSD physiological reactions, there's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of people on the internet. It's like, oh, trigger warnings. So what trigger warnings became to many people interpreting this was that it was coddling people.
Got it.
And it became not an issue of rape scenes or scenes of war or violence that might trigger PTSD, and more the other thing I'll say is that some people were misusing the term trigger warning on our side of the fence.
Yeah.
So they would say like, I don't like Republicans. I need a trigger warning before. So now if you have actual PTSD with Republicans, which could happen, then great. But yeah. I'm guessing you just really hate Republicans, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or you just really hate Donald Trump or something, and you don't know what to do with those feelings of anger, and then you say, I need a trigger warning for that.
That might be a way to express anger.
What?
To perhaps misuse the term, this is a way of me protesting. This could be, if I don't have PTSD, this could be a way of me protesting against something I don't like.
Right. Which is fine to protest.
Sure, go for it.
But don't use the term trigger warning.
No, it affects the people who really need that.
Right.
Oh,
it's sort of like people who use the the comfort animals when they don't really need it,
yeah.
and they just like traveling with their dog.
Yeah.
And there are people who legitimately need that, and there are people who are bastardizing it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
So, but from my estimation, and there's no way to know, this is anecdotal.
Sure.
Those incidences were not very frequent compared to the legitimate uses of trigger warning.
What you're saying is that people attack the use of that, the good use of that, because, you know, they have their own agenda or something.
Right. Because, okay. Well, one, because they don't understand PTSD,
right.
and they have a general ageist notion that college students are wussies.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And a bunch of privileged little elitist assholes, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, Psychology Today has this article, and it says, Harvard study, trigger warnings might coddle the mind.
Oh, God.
So does that make sense more to you
We're
now?
We're already off.
Yeah. So, let me read this paragraph. Trigger warnings aren't just bad for trauma survivors and people who suffer from PTSD. Trigger warnings aren't just bad for... Okay. According to the Harvard study, for people who have not experienced trauma, trigger warnings seem to decrease the belief... No, this is not the section I wanted to read. Where am I here? Essential for trauma survivors to go through life constantly being warned. I can't remember. Where was the quote here? Oh, okay, here we go. Harvard psychology professor and PTSD expert Dr. Richard McNally explained in a 2016 essay in the New York Times that, quote, severe emotional reactions triggered by course material are a signal that students need to prioritize their mental health and obtain evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapies that will help them overcome PTSD.
Oh.
That makes sense to you, right?
Sure.
Okay, so I just want to read this out loud again because the next sentence basically doesn't understand the sentence that they just wrote. Okay? So, severe emotional reactions triggered by course material are a signal that students need to get help.
Yeah.
Makes sense, right?
Sure.
That's actually a wonderful statement.
That's a great statement.
If a student came to me and said, I just saw something in class today and it really stressed me out, I would say that's a signal that you might have PTSD and you should get help for that because you are suffering and you deserve to be treated, you know? And I'll tell you out there, PTSD treatment is one of the most efficient. We can cure PTSD in people. Like I've literally cured PTSD in people. You have too.
Oh, yeah.
It can be done. It's one of the few things that can actually like respond very well because it's so behavioral, you know, and physiological that it's just a matter of habituation.
It's often very fast.
It can be, yeah. The trick is that for some people, it's so scary to even begin exposure.
Right.
Or the trauma is so pervasive that it takes years to kind of slowly get there.
Yeah.
Or they've been traumatized by relationships and they need to engage in a relationship to begin exposure, or the relationship is the exposure.
Sure. So complex PTSD is the treatment is still very similar, but it takes longer.
Yeah.
And it's probably more new. Subtle. Does that sound like?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you have PTSD from a car crash and doesn't involve any complexity, then habituating yourself to car crashes is less nuanced.
Yeah.
Okay, so they say, Harvard expert says severe emotional reactions, you know, as being triggered by something in a course is an indication that you need help. And then the next sentence. So this is Psychology Today, right? It's not just some blogger. In other words, severe emotional reactions are not an indication that professors or others should warn students in advance.
What?
Yeah. So I just want to read the sentence as it, I'm not going to paraphrase it. This is what the expert said. Severe emotional reactions triggered by course material are a signal that students need to prioritize their mental health and obtain evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapies that will help them overcome PTSD. Unquote. The next sentence. In other words, severe emotional reactions are not an indication that professors or others should warn students in advance.
That has nothing to... It's apples and oranges.
Apples and oranges.
It's really apples and stupid oranges is what it is.
I mean, in other words,
yeah,
you know, no. You have just either you can't this author wrote the sentence before
They published that?
Yes.
Where's the editor?
It's in the next sentence. Constantly warning people with PTSD about potential triggers could potentially even interfere with their recovery. Okay.
No.
Where'd you get that? And then here comes the next, you know, so this is all the same paragraph.
Yeah.
Okay. As Lakianoff and Haidt point out in their newest book, The Coddling of the American Mind.
Uh-oh.
The avoidance of triggers is not a treatment for PTSD.
Well, right.
It is a classic symptom of it.
Well, right.
In fact, Dr. McNally, according to Dr. McNally, therapies that promote recovery from PTSD involve gradual systematic exposure to traumatic memories until the capacity of those memories to trigger distress diminishes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Sudden fucking exposure in class when you're not ready for it and you have no actual therapy around you to help you integrate and recover and habituate is actually going to spike one's distress and compound the PTSD. Now, they were not just raped on a date when they were 16, but now they have been essentially raped in class by being exposed to a rape on the screen. And now you and society and this author of Psychology Today are participating in the continuing rape and violence against human beings.
Crazy. I mean, that's just stupid. That's just stupid. That's somebody pushing an agenda, not somebody actually interested in welfare. Yeah.
Ageism.
Because the thing is they mean they even say it. It's got to be systematic.
Yeah. Involve gradual systemic exposure to memories to trigger, to help someone have the distress diminish.
Right.
This is all one paragraph.
One of the things that's missing is that when people are in treatment for PTSD, they're in treatment because they have an interest in getting better. And so they're volunteering and participating. But if you just show up in a class, you're not volunteering or participating. You're just kind of along for the ride that the professor's, you know, wanting to whatever they're doing.
Now, if a professor said, I come to my class if you have trauma around rape, and I will gradually expose you to the rape, to rape stimuli, to help you recover from your PTSD, it would still be a terrible model because no one would be there. But
no.
But at least people would know their sign. You know,
sure.
There's this notion of like, now I will say there is a form of therapy called it's an exposure type. It's not the prolonged, but it's I can't remember the term in behaviorism, but it's like a sudden exposure.
Flooding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that can work, but can also really not work.
well, you know, a person volunteers for that.
Right. That's the whole point.
That's the point.
Yeah. It's like, according to this article and according to a lot of people in our society, it's who I guess they really just don't understand PTSD.
Right.
It's like this notion. There's, I guess, you know, I find that a lot of these, this super paternal, you know, it's just like you have every parent has been through a situation where their kid is whining about something. And they're applying it to this. They think that PTSD sufferers are whining, you know? It's like, because I think they associate mental health awareness with liberalism and with just a political view you just don't like or being childish or something.
Right.
And that's why I bring in the vets, because it's like, if you're a Republican, you're likely to sympathize with veterans, you know?
More so,
I guess.
Yeah.
And so, not to denigrate like Republicans who have morals and can sift through the rhetoric. I mean, people on both sides of the aisle, honestly, are guilty of wrongheadedness for sure.
Oh, sure.
But anyway, so everyone's been through, as a parent, you know, your daughter is like, ew, spaghetti is gross. And like, as a parent, you're like, oh my God. Like, okay, by implication, this kid's not going to eat their spaghetti because they're grossed out by it. They've had spaghetti hundreds of times before. The kid is in a bad mood and is going through the terrible fives or whatever and is just being a dick to me right now. If I give in, I have to throw away perfectly good food. They're going to be hungry later, and guess what? They're going to ask for ice cream. I've been through this every fucking night. Do you know what I mean? You're not actually grossed out by the spaghetti, kid. Eat the spaghetti.
Yeah.
Eat it. I don't want to. It's gross. Look at it. It's gross. Get over it, kid. Eat the fucking spaghetti, you know.
Power like, struggle.
Yeah. So, you know, every parent has been through that.
Sure.
And that's what they're, because they're so stupid, yeah, they can't like overcome their simplistic way of looking at the world, that they see people suffering from legitimate physiological PTSD as like complaining little kids.
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we get back, let's be disgusted with some more articles. What do you say?
Sounds good.
All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't become a patron of the podcast, do so now. Part of being a patron of the podcast, if you're a $20 patron, I will physically wrap a mug that I'm holding in front of me right now and mail it to you. You have to be in North America. If you're in Great Britain or something, it costs like $150 or something to mail a mug across the ocean, which makes sense.
Well, will you send them a picture of the mug?
I'll send you some stickers. How about that? For sure, because that's actually not so bad. But every once in a while, I update the mug. And honestly, this is a really great mug. It has the best handle because all four fingers. You know, have you ever had a coffee mug where only two fingers fit?
Right.
It's like,
it hurts.
Why would that? You know, it'd be like having a suitcase that was like, you know, just big, you know, the handle just big enough for two fingers. It's like, and it's tall, so it can fit lots of coffee in this thing. And
beer.
And I can't vouch for this, but I'm pretty sure this mug keeps your coffee warm for 24 hours. That's what I'll say. But I updated the mug and I put Bob's face on it.
Oh,
and so I thought I would give Bob here in the podcast. The new mug.
I think I was drunk in this picture.
Let me see the picture. Remind me. That was your birthday party in your back. No, that was a Christmas party. That was one of the Christmas parties.
Oh,
The Michael and Beth Christmas party.
Yeah. Yeah, they call it the Quanchonimus party.
Yeah.
It is the Kwanzaa Hanukkah Christmas party.
Right.
Because there are people of all faiths, and none, and there have been we've had that party going on 21 years now or something, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, I haven't been to most of them. I think you have, but I was there in the beginning. I remember. In fact, I think they were the first people who introduced me to the idea of white elephant. I had never heard of white elephant. In 1997, I was like, white elephant, what is this? And back then it was just like six people that was doing the white elephant.
Right.
So it didn't take very long.
Yeah.
But now it's become a whole,
it's like 35
whole thing.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a $100 patron to the podcast, you actually might get an invitation to the party. So, you know,
just saying. Okay. So let's read another article here.
Thanks for the mug. It's really cool.
Sure. Actually, I thought we would do a personality test. What do you say?
I think I have one. A personality, I mean.
Yeah. So let's both answer these questions, but I'm going to tabulate for you because I think, so this is another, this is on the Psych Central website, which is kind of like supposed to be a little step up from Psychology Today.
Okay.
But anyway.
What are we assessing?
Personality. But it's only it's a big five. So do you know the big five? Among psychologists, they don't regard like Myers-Briggs or other kinds of personality because it's really, really hard to define personality. And it's also hard to find constructs that actually hold up you know, because it's one thing to call someone like, oh, you're type A, for example. Type A is something that's often thrown out.
Right.
And it's like, when you actually ask people what type A means, they often don't know what psychologists mean by type A. And two, the personality characteristics that they describe as like, oh, because by definition, if you have a type A personality, you would have a type B or something outside of type A.
Right.
You know, you are born with dark skin or you're born with light skin or there's a spectrum or something. You know, there's a way to kind of differentiate between people. Well, when sometimes culture will think that a certain personality characteristic or criteria will fit together when in fact they don't really.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like saying, in terms of physicality, it'd be like saying people with dark skin are tall.
Right.
Or something, you know. Yeah. Oh, you know, those tall, darks, you know, it's like those things actually don't correlate.
They're,
you know,
independent.
What I mean? There's tall and short. Anyway,
yeah,
I'm not really describing it very well, but Big Five is the five personality traits spectrums that psychologists over time have actually agreed on as holding water in terms of
universality.
Well, and being consistent across cultures with regards to the measures actually measure something and can predict behavior. That's always the big thing. It's like when you measure something, when you measure someone's personality, can you predict behavior in the future? Or can you predict reactions to things in the future? You know
Makes
what I
sense.
Mean? Right. So anyway, so this is a very quick, you know, Big Five personality inventories will be, you know, hundreds of questions. This has 10, so I'm sure it's not very accurate. But anyway, so Bob.
Yes.
This is all on like agree to disagree from strongly, moderately, a little, neither, you know, da-da-da.
Are they numbers?
No.
Okay.
But yeah.
Okay.
So I see myself as extroverted and enthusiastic. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Disagree.
How disagree? Strong, moderate, little?
Moderate.
Okay. I see myself critical and quarrelsome. Disagree.
Disagree.
Or
moderate.
Moderate. I see myself as dependable and self-disciplined.
Agree.
A little, moderate, strongly.
Dependable and self-disciplined?
Yeah.
Moderate.
Okay. I see myself as anxious and easily upset. Disagree or agree?
Disagree.
A little, moderately, or strongly?
Boy, my first hit was a little, but that doesn't even sound like me. Read it again.
I see myself as anxious and easily upset.
Oh, I hate these. It's like, it depends.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Okay, so moderate.
Okay. I see myself as open to new experiences and I'm complex.
You know, the problem with these questions is there's two things and they don't...
Well, I'm actually reading them more grammatically correct, but... The way this is written is, yeah. I see myself as open to new experiences, comma, complex.
What the hell does that mean?
Yeah. I see myself as open to new experiences, complex. like
I have an open to new experiences, complex. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess agree a little.
Okay. I see myself as reserved, quiet. Disagree or agree?
Disagree a little.
I see myself as sympathetic, warm.
Agree a lot.
Strongly.
Yeah.
I see myself as disorganized, careless.
No, disagree a lot. Strongly.
I see myself as calm, emotionally stable.
Oh, well, what day is it? disagree a little.
Okay. I see myself as conventional, uncreative.
Disagree a lot. Strongly.
Okay. Score my short personality. Okay. So you are very agreeable. Mm. So the big five are extroversion, as opposed to introversion.
Yeah.
Agreeable versus disagreeable, conscientiousness, emotional stability, and open to experiences.
Okay.
That's the big five.
All right.
So you are slightly not extroverted.
Yeah.
You are very agreeable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you're a 6.5 on agreeable, and I think it's out of 7, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe out of 10, not sure. No, I think it's out of 7. So you're extremely agreeable, according to this 10-question inventory.
I agree.
You're extremely conscientious. Conscientious is you greatly value self-discipline, acting dutifully, and aiming for achievement.
Yeah, that's probably true.
You have a preference for planned rather than spontaneous behavior.
Sometimes. A lot of the time. I like spontaneity when it's planned, yeah.
You seek to avoid trouble and achieve high levels of success through purposeful planning and persistence.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah. You are positively regarded by others as intelligent and reliable. That's true.
Lies.
Those are true. I consider you to be very intelligent and very reliable. For example, when we schedule these podcasts, like sometimes months in advance, yeah. We'll be like, okay, how about this Saturday? Because you come over on Saturday, right. And I'm like, okay, how about this Saturday? And you're like, and then we're like, oh, I'm out of town. And then we're like, okay, 3 months from now on Saturday, you'll come at 11, and like, boom, you're there at 11. Sometimes, however, others may see you as compulsive, perfectionistic, or a workaholic.
Ooh, you know me pretty well. What do you think?
I don't know if I know you that well. You know certainly, well.
I think you know me as well as anybody except maybe Colleen.
Yeah. A workaholic. I don't think you're a workaholic.
Not that.
I mean, I think you have veins of perfectionism.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. What am I talking about? You wrote an entire novel and a pop-up book, by the way. A legit pop-up book and a legit novel, and against everyone's coaching, including legit editors, you have refused to publish it out of, I believe, perfectionism.
Yeah, probably. It's also not done. What else would a perfectionist say? Well, what is this? Also says I'm compulsive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that's true?
You have a compulsive vulnerability that you've, you know, you manage pretty well.
Oh, okay.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
It says you're sort of midland emotionally stable, meaning that you have, you know, you're not like, I don't know, I don't know how this works out in terms of averages, but,
right.
But you're like somewhat emotionally stable, I think is what it means. And you're pretty open to experiences, which I think is true as well.
Oh.
You know, you're the sort of person who likes to meet new people and do new things. And I mean, maybe not in your current lifestyle, but
that's true.
You have that capacity. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
Being on the podcast, I think is, you know, some indication of open, because you never know what I'm going to do to you. When
that's
you
true. Out. Colleen says to me this morning, what are you guys talking about? And I'm like, yeah, I never know.
Let's do just one more personality test.
Okay.
This is called Dr. Phil's personality test.
Oh, well, you know then.
Yeah. So again, Psych Central, supposed to, I don't know how legit, I sometimes find good Psych Central articles, but anyway, so I just find this one to be just kind of funny. It's only 10 questions. When do you feel your best? In the morning, during the afternoon and early evening, or late at night?
Night.
You usually walk fairly fast with long steps, fairly fast with small steps, less fast head up, looking the world in the face, less fast head down, or very slowly.
Less fast head down.
Less fast head down. When talking to, do you watch Arrested Development?
I have.
Hair up, glasses off. Glasses on, hair up. Do you remember that scene where Job is in the copy room with the girl who always shows her boobs all the time?
No.
You don't remember that? Say goodbye to these, Michael. Anyway. You know, they recently came out with season 5.
Right.
Did you watch it?
No.
And I just did not like it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so going back to the day, like early aughts when Arrested Development first came out, I was just infatuated with the show. Back in a time when it was like didn't have very good ratings and not a lot of people watched it, and I loved it and was so bummed when it was taken off the air. Then Netflix, like 10 years later, had season 4.
Right.
And I liked it, you know, and I was like, ah, it's not as good as the original. But I was like, yeah, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then this recent bout, what they did was they took season four and re-edited it to make it better. Did you watch season four when it came out? So season four had all these problems because all these people were big stars now. You know, you had Michael Cera, you had Jason Bateman. You had the guy...
Jeffrey Tambor.
You had just big names. Right. And so...
David Cross, Jessica Walter.
Right. And so they couldn't... So originally, David Cross. Originally, all the people were kind of no names to some extent.
Yeah.
Jason Bateman, I don't think, had done anything around that time much at all. Uh-huh. Like, and so in order to make it budgetarily possible, what they did was they filmed when people were available. And so what that meant was the production of the show, there was very few moments where more than one or two stars were in a scene. And so I think they would just take like a couple days and shoot like a lot of scenes with one person. And so a lot of the stories are these kind of like isolated stories about one or two people. And then they sort of had to cleverly interweave them into a few scenes where they're all there. You know, there's like one or two days where all the stars are on set doing something. And there were even times where it was obviously green screened, like where the Fonzie, you know, was green screened into a scene. Can you imagine, like, when you see that, you know, they obviously took a screen grab of a background of the scene they had shot and said, and then they just green screened it. It just looks so dumb. But anyway, so people were upset about that. And so they, and the whole season was something like 10 episodes, and all 10 episodes took place at the kind of the same timeline. And so each episode was like a flashback to the, you know, and it was like so confusing. Whereas the original Arrested Development, each episode was kind of like its own little unit.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like it was like a Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, like it began with a premise and then it wrapped up. And there were themes across the episodes for sure.
Sure.
But you could watch one episode on season two and not know much about the storyline and still be entertained. Right. Whereas like the season four Arrested Development, it was like if you just watched episode five, you'd be like, what in the world is happening?
Right.
So then, but I liked it. And then they came out with, and then like 5 years later or something, they came out with season five, right? So in preparation for that, I went back for fun and watched seasons one through three. And then decided to watch the remix of four and then five. I was like, this is going to be a Arrested Development month for me. I'm going to like really go for it. And what I found was with some distance, season one and two are hilarious. Even season three of the original series is not that funny.
Oh, wow.
It's the season with Charlize Theron. Do you remember that season?
No,
She's like a British. It's kind of... And there's some problematic things in that season too, because so Charlize Theron plays, you know, someone with developmental. She's developmentally disabled.
Wow.
She essentially, according to the show, has the mentality of like a 5-year-old, but Jason Bateman's character, Michael Bluth, doesn't realize that and is dating her, thinking that she's just this quirky, fun, ironic person. And that's kind of dark.
It's pretty dark.
You know?
Yeah.
And not funny also. It's just like the third. So then I'm already like, oh, season three, it's not that funny.
Yeah.
And then I get to season four with the remix and I'm like, man, this is, I don't even think I could sit through this. So then I was like, I've already seen season four, so I'll just skip to season five. Got like 1.5 episodes in season five and was like, this is a slog.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think this is very funny.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the problems is Michael Cera's character, George Michael Bluth, in the original series, was hilarious, like a real specific, very innocent, happy kid. Seasons 4 and 5, he's, you know, he's older now. He's not a teenager anymore. He's like 30 years old now. And the way they write his character is he's like a dark asshole kind of a thing, you know? And I don't know if that's like his sort of thing, like he just doesn't want to play nice people anymore or something.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there were all the political problems with Tambor having sexually harassed people on set. And then Jason Bateman and I think David Cross,
right?
Defending Tambor in some ways. So that sort of put a pall on the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm pretty disappointed. And I don't care if there's a season 6. So anyway, but if you're interested in commenting, let me know. Contact@psychologyinseattle.com. This was the episode in which I just talked about Arrested Development for 50 minutes. Okay, getting back to your personality. So I asked you, when do you feel your best? Late at night.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I feel like that's me too, but that's changing.
Yeah, right.
For me as I get older.
What
I feel
is it?
Like, well, I feel like it can be in the morning for me now.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Right.
But back in the day, for sure, man, like I knew I was at my cognitive best at like 11 at night.
National fact hour.
You usually walk less fast and head down.
Head down, yeah.
That seems interesting to me. You seem like a personality of a fast walker, but you're not. You're a slow walker.
I think I'm kind of a slow walker, yeah.
I'm a fast walker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are.
I take long steps, yeah. But you're less fast head down. What do you mean head down? Like, just like, I don't want to look at people in the eye.
I like, I'm thinking about me going to the grocery store. I just look at the shit on the walls and stuff. I don't even, yeah.
Okay. When talking to people, you stand with your arms folded. You have your hands clasped. You have one or both of your hands on your hips. You touch or push the person to whom you are talking. Mm-hmm. You play with your ear or hair, touch your chin, or smooth your hair. Which one are you? So stand with your arms folded,
no.
Hands clasped.
Sometimes.
Have one or both of your hands at your hips.
No, never.
Touch or push the person with whom you're talking.
That's probably most likely.
Or play with your hair.
No, I don't play with my hair.
Okay, well, touch the person you're talking to.
Yeah.
When relaxing, let's see, what am I?
What are you?
I'm probably that person, too.
Yeah.
Although I do put my hands on my hips a lot. Like I find that it's very comfortable. I find myself thinking I'm like a cowboy because I'll put my thumbs in my belt.
Uh-huh.
It looks ridiculous, but it's comfortable. I don't know. When relaxing, you sit with your knees bent with your legs neatly side by side. No, neither one of us are like that. So like this.
Oh, no.
So when relaxing, you sit very, very posturesque.
Oh, definitely.
When relaxing, you sit with your legs crossed.
Mm-hmm.
When relaxing, you sit with your legs stretched out or straight. Oh, that's me.
Uh-huh.
When relaxing, you sit with one leg curled under you. Oh, that's me too. I do that too. I'm very fidgety. I'm a very fidgety sitter.
Right.
I have noticed that. I noticed that a long time ago about. Because as a therapist, I sit for an hour at a time.
Right.
In the same chair talking to someone. And I notice that 99% of my clients will sit down in one position and never move. They just sit there and they talk and they listen. For me, every 30 seconds I'm shifting in my chair.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't get comfortable. Just sit. Like if I torture for me, if the Taliban caught me, would be making me sit in one spot, regardless of what position that would be. I'd just be slowly going insane because I'd have to fidget.
So no Buddhist meditation for you?
No. What about you? Like, so are you a fidgeter?
I move, but I think if I'm sitting and relaxing. Well, it's funny. Colleen said to me, if you sit down, you sit like I'm sitting like this. Not legs together, but I sit like this.
Yeah, okay. Kind of a slight man spreader.
Yeah, slight man spreader, yeah.
Okay.
But I didn't know that about myself. I thought I'd just stick my legs up on whatever's in front of me.
If I could have my way, yeah. I would recline with my legs up every time. And over time, I just started doing that at work. You know, I would just put my feet up on my desk and talk to people. I'd take my shoes off and I'd put my feet up. And after a while, I realized that that wasn't normal. To me, it seemed totally normal because, I don't know, it just felt normal.
Yeah.
It certainly felt comfortable.
Right.
I mean, I would take naps like that. I would sit in my office chair. Sure. I'd take my shoes off, put my feet up on my desk, and just sort of hang my head and fall asleep.
Absolutely.
And but eventually, like, a student would be, like, a little braver later on into the program. They'd be like, yeah, I remember the first time I met you in your office, and you just, like, took your shoes off, which I found to be, like, really unprofessional. And then you put your feet up on your desk mm-hmm. when you were talking to me mm-hmm. with your socks, you know? Yeah. And I think it's a Japanese thing. Like, it's very normal for Japanese people to be, it's, you know, you walk into a Japanese house, you take your shoes off.
Take your shoes off.
You walk into a Japanese restaurant, you take your shoes off.
Right.
Like, you know, in some restaurants with tatami. You don't ever step with your shoes on a tatami mat. And a lot of houses are like, you know,
yeah.
at least traditionally, there's a lot of, you know, in Japan, they don't measure their houses by square meter or square foot or anything. You know, in the United States, it's like everything's like, well, how many square foot? Like,
sure.
How many square foot is your house, Bob?
It's 1,200 and change.
Right. So the fact that you just know that right. off the top of your head, like right. 1,200, you know, 1,230. Some people know down to the, you know, the single digit. Right. And whereas in Japan, it's all on tatami mat. So people will say, you know, my apartment is 9 tatami mats.
Wow.
Yeah. It'll fit exactly 9 tatami mats. You know what I mean?
They're standard sizes?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because it's designed to like, there's yeah. a standard, and tatami mats are like, I'm going to say like 6x3 or something. Uh-huh. They could be 8x4. I'm not sure. But.
That's cool.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
It's like so traditional, you know?
Right.
Okay. So are you legs crossed, legs stretched out, or leg curled underneath you?
I guess stretched out.
Stretched out.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I am too. When someone really amuses you, you react with a big appreciative laugh. That's definitely you.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to mark that now. The other ones are a laugh, but not a loud one. A quiet chuckle. A sheepish smile. No, you're one of the biggest appreciative laughers I've ever met.
Thank you.
When you go to a party, maybe that's part of your openness to experience part. Like you like to experience life, you know. When you go to a party or a social gathering, you make a loud entrance so that everyone notices you. I'm going to mark that for you right there. make a quiet entrance looking around for someone you know. Make the quietest entrance trying to stay unnoticed. Yeah, you're definitely on the make a loud entrance.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not bad. You're a jovial,
yeah.
self-deprecating person. you're working very hard, concentrating hard, and you're interrupted. You welcome a break, or you feel extremely irritated by the interruption, or you vary between these two extremes, between welcoming the break and feeling extremely irritated. I feel like I can't answer this question for you because I don't know how you do.
That's a good question. It depends. Like at work, I definitely will just go with it. I'll just welcome the break because I figure I'm going to work with that too. And at home, it depends. Like if I'm talking about something that's deeply personal, I can get irritated. But most of the time, I'd say I just like go with what comes my way. I welcome the break.
Yeah, that is consistent with because you're not like a rigid. You're not rigid. One and two. I think you're self-aware enough to know like what's the bigger picture here.
Right.
Which of the following colors do you like the most?
Oh.
Red, orange, black, yellow, light blue. Yellow, light blue is in the same category. Green, dark blue, purple, white, brown, and gray.
Green.
Green. Okay. I don't know what sort of personality that's supposed to...
Dr. Phil's going to get in my head.
Yeah. I think for me, it's... It used to be purple when I was a kid, and I think I just chose purple because no one else chose purple. I think that's why, because when you're a kid, like everyone has a favorite color.
There's a personality test right there.
Right. And then I really loved red and blue because that's what Spider-Man was. Mm. And I think I did a fair amount of coloring books with Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man. And then it was definitely light blue. Like I loved light blue at one point, aqua blue.
Nice color.
Now it's like, why would you choose a favorite color?
Yeah, it's more like I have to.
An orange. I think I liked orange for a while. Anyway, when you are in bed at night, in those last few moments before going to sleep, you are stretched out on your back, stretch out face down in your stomach, on your side, slightly curled, with your head on one arm, with your head under the covers. Yes, I'm trying to suffocate myself to sleep. How do you sleep is the answer to this question.
On my side.
On your side, slightly curled, or with your head on an arm?
Slightly curled.
Slightly curled. So your arms are in front of your body.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which is bugging my shoulders, but nonetheless, that's how it is.
Is it bad for your shoulders?
It bugs them. I stretch funny. I think it's actually making my spine curve.
Oh.
Yeah.
I've been getting this ad on Facebook for some reason where it has one of those like contraptions that allows you to sleep on your side, and the pillow kind of supports your arm going through this like hole.
I never heard of that.
It's like a giant sort of weird pillow with various different, you'd have to see it, but it's like a wedge shape and starts at your hip and goes all the way up to your head, and it has a hole for your arm.
That's cool.
So it relieves that pressure on your arm somehow, and it puts the pressure on your side.
On your side. Support there.
Yeah. And then it has a little pillow for your head and the pillow comes down from your head. And you can kind of cradle it. You can kind of like, it's like you're spooning part of the pillow. It's weird. You have to see it, but maybe you should buy one of those things.
Yeah.
It's also supposed to be good for gastric reflux. Do you have reflux?
No.
I do.
You do?
Yeah. So it's like sleeping with a little bit of a, you know, keeps the gastric juices in your stomach.
In your stomach, yeah.
I start off on my side with I put my arm under my pillow. And so I guess my head is on my arm, but it's sort of the pillow's in between.
Right.
And then just as I'm falling asleep, I get on my back and then I fall asleep. And I'm pretty sure I sleep on my back throughout the night.
Yeah.
I used to do the same process, but on my stomach. I would start on my stomach until I would sort of drift off and then realize I'm on my stomach, and then I'd flip over.
I can't ever sleep on my stomach. I don't know how y'all do that. It's like kills my neck.
Well, there's a way to sort of use the pillow as, I don't know, there was a way I did it, but I could only handle it for a little bit of time, but I found it to be very relaxing to my spine. It's part of my fidgeting thing is that as soon as I lay down, it often takes me a little bit to fall asleep. And because I need to fidget in bed. I don't think I ever drew this connection before, that if I just logically, I should just start on my back, right? But if it takes me longer than 3 minutes to fall asleep, I'll get fidgety and I'll have to move.
Yeah.
And sometimes that'll happen where I'll start on my side and then I'll go, okay, I think I'm about to fall asleep. You know, you get that feeling where you're kind of falling, you know? And so I go, okay, get on my back. And then 5-10 minutes will go by, I haven't fallen asleep. Well, I got to fidget. So now I got to go back to my side or the other side maybe.
Right.
And then I got to like wait there for a bit until I drift off. Then I got to get back on my back. You know what I mean? Anyway, last question. You often dream that you are falling, fighting or struggling, searching for something or somebody, flying or floating. You usually have dreamless sleep. Your dreams are always pleasant.
None of the above. I mean, everybody has all those dreams at some point. But I have to pick one? Can you read them again?
Falling, fighting, struggling, searching, flying, floating, dreamless sleep, or pleasant dreams.
Last night, I dreamed I was coming to your house to do a podcast, honest to God.
Oh.
Yeah, and your house was next to a church, and I needed a code to get into your house, but the church was open so I could walk down their path to get to your place, which is no place I ever been before. And at some point, I really had to poo. And so so I left your front porch or whatever, wherever your door was, and went through the church, you know, little walkway or whatever, out to the sidewalk and down the street to like a public bathroom. And it was sort of like Edmonds Main Street, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So quaint little
yeah.
Shore town.
Yeah. And I almost pooped my pants. Like, I was pooping while I was sitting down on the thing and get my pants down all at once. So I'd say searching. I'm going with searching on this one.
You could also say fighting or struggling. But yeah, okay, searching for someone. You're searching for me. Man, Freud and I can have a field day with this dream.
Yeah, go for it. There's
well, what's your associations with churches? I mean, you have to have some association.
Sure, yeah. We were raised Catholic-ish, sort of. I don't like churches. No, that's not true. I actually like churches. I don't like priests and hierarchy. But the churches themselves are really cool. But they're also sort of boring and tiresome.
And pooping. What are your association with having to find a bathroom for... Did you actually have to poop in real life, do you think?
Right, because it was last night. And I was wondering that myself, but no, I don't think so.
Okay.
Maybe I had gas.
Okay.
Yeah, Colleen's been telling me I fart in my sleep these days.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
I think everyone does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard some stat that the average person farts like 13 times a day, including while they're sleeping.
Oh.
And which I find to be a little high, but regardless, the stat is like, cuz some people will say I haven't farted in months, you know. They'll say stuff like that, and then I've always been like, well, it must come out when you're sleeping.
Slumping, yeah, right. Yeah. Or there's Michael who farts 13 times an hour.
Oh, really? I used to fart a lot more than I do now.
Right?
I think my diet is just better.
Yeah.
And so I can legitimately go for days without knowing if I'm farting or not.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Me too, except it's usually like about 20 minutes.
I mean, certainly there are certain... What makes you fart?
It's the gas. I don't know. Because I can't seem a rhyme or reason to it.
For me, hummus.
Oh, yeah, that would do it.
And garlic. For a while, there was this trend to have pizzas with full garlic cloves. Do you remember that trend?
No.
It was like
awful.
It was in the aughts. I feel like there was a lot of pizza with just like 30 full cloves, you know, the sections or whatever of cooked garlic.
Right.
And it tasted great because cooked garlic it mellows it, right?
It mellows,
it makes it kind of like a cooked onion kind of thing. But the farts would smell, you know. Well, I guess, you know, it's like, a little bit of pesto in the air right now. Okay, let's score your personality. What would Dr. Phil say about you?
Yeah, right.
Okay, so you are, you scored a 46.
Oh.
So there you go. And you are titled, your personality is the lively center of attention. I don't know how answering that your favorite color was green.
Sure.
Is, this is a, okay, so here's the different scoring. So you have... On one of this spectrum, you're the shy warrior, and then you're the careful plotter, and then you're the loyal friend, and then you're the lively center of attention, and then you're the natural leader, and then you're the vain, self-centered leader. So I think this is basically an extroversion scale. So you're like in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations. You've taken a personality quiz for entertainment. As far as we can tell, there's no scientific backing for this quiz. So... supposedly, Dr. Phil scored 55, which is higher than you on that. This looks to be an extroversion scale. And Oprah scored a 38, which is... So you're right in the middle of Dr. Phil and Oprah.
Okay.
If Dr. Phil's personality and Oprah's personality were to sandwich... They would sandwich you. You would be the...
Their love child.
Yeah. Or you would be the third wheel in their 69 situation. But you scored 46, so I don't know how that makes any sense. All right, well, that does it for that weird episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for taking those tests. How do you feel after taking those tests, Rob?
I feel closer to Dr. Phil. Look at me.
I like the color green. That says so much about personality. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because...
You deserve it.